This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a child, my guest Mary Gordon wanted to be a nun, but when she grew up, she had serious differences with the church. She came to think of the Catholic Church as an institution shaped and ruled by celibate males who had a history of hatred and fear of the body, a hatred which was expressed in the rituals they created. Now Gordon is considered one of the leading American novelists dealing with Catholicism. Her fiction is also about families, sexual love and parental love, and the burden of responsibility. Gordon's novels include Final Payments, The Company of Women, Men and Angels, and The Other Side. Her new book is a collection of essays called Good Boys and Dead Girls. Mary Gordon is married and has two children, and I told her I thought she was lucky because she loves having a family, and family is also central to her fiction.
Well, I like being part of the family that I was able to invent. I'm not so wild about being part of the family that I came from. One of the things that I try to do, which is probably an illusory and a doomed effort, is to try to make a family that's different from the one that I came from.
In one of the essays in your new collection, you write that most of your family considers you an embarrassment or a lost soul. Is that because of what your writing is about?
Yes, in part, and in a large part, they consider that what I'm writing about is shameful. They all, for some reason that's really mysterious to me, think that I write dirty books. I feel like saying, you want to see a dirty book? I'll show you a dirty book. They're mine. Books are not dirty. But any mention of sex is considered really vile to them. Also, I'm critical of the church. And that they consider unacceptable. But the very fact that I became a writer instead of something that they would consider useful or predictable is in itself kind of an embarrassment. If I were a court stenographer or if I had some sort of civil service rating, they would really be much more comfortable with me. The fact is that a writer is a kind of a spiller of the beans, and they're very uncomfortable with that.
Do you tell family secrets, or what is perceived as family secrets in your novels?
No, not so much. I think they're just afraid that I always will. And of course, you know, they're paranoid, so they will see things in there as relating to them, which really don't. But mainly they think I'm anti-Catholic and a slut. So that's the...
Well, you know, it must be very interesting to have your extended family become book critics, you know, when they read your books, because your books aren't the kind of books they'd be reading. They're probably not exposed to the kind of books that you
they
write.
They don't read them. They read the first couple of pages, and then their criticism for them is very kinesthetic. They throw the book out. They burn it. They have these, you know, ritual acts involving hurling, ripping. That's the kind of criticism they practice. But the criticism doesn't include reading. It just includes, you know, some sort of vague notion that they get from hearsay or they might read reviews in their local paper.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Mary Gordon, and her latest book is a collection of essays. It's called Good Boys and Dead Girls. Now, I know you were very religious when you were growing up, and you write about that in your new collection of essays, and you describe how you used to put thorns in your shoes, you know, trying to emulate the saints. Did your parents approve of that, or did they think you were a little nuts?
Well, is it both, in a way. My mother, my father died when I was 7, so most of my thorn period occurred after his death and might have been connected to it in some way. But my mother was and is a funny combination of being extremely devout and extremely hard-headed. So I remember one time I was 10, and I used to sleep with a little crucifix under my pillow, and I woke up one morning, and there was an imprint of a cross on my chest, and I thought I had the stigmata. And I had read many, many books about stigmatists, so I knew exactly how to behave. I was not going to be taken by surprise. And stigmatists always downplayed it, because you would tell a bishop, the bishop wouldn't believe you, and you'd have to be very cool till you finally got to the Pope, and he'd say, that's right, you do have the stigmata. So I went downstairs to my mother, and I said, well, Mom, I've got it. And she said, you've got what? And I said, well, I've got the stigmata. And she said, what? I said, I'll be bleeding a lot on Fridays, but it's okay. Don't worry. It's sacred blood, and, you know, it'll be fine. And she turned to me and she said, "You damn fool, you slept on your crucifix. What do you think?" And I said, "Oh, yes, you know, that's what they all say. They, no one ever believes you." And then as the day went on and the imprint of the cross faded from my chest, I realized that she was right. But in some ways, it didn't surprise her to have a daughter who would come downstairs and say, "Hi, I have the stigmata." But she was not going to really buy into it fully. Although I wonder what would have happened if I'd really had it. She probably would have sort of liked it. I think if I had had the stigmata, my mother would have really supported me in the same way that she supported me when I got into trouble with the nuns. I mean, she had that kind of very steadfast quality, so that even when all her brothers and sisters are telling her that I write dirty books, she doesn't listen to them, and she tells them that I haven't, even though she thinks I do too. But she would always kind of make a little, you know, wagon train of one around me.
I want to get back to those thorns in your shoes. Would your mother ever try to take them out? I mean, did the nuns know that you were doing this?
They might not have known that I was doing it, but there was such a tradition of that it was in the discourse, so that they wouldn't have been surprised, and they would have made only a half-hearted attempt to get me to stop doing it. But in their heart, they would have thought it was a good thing.
Do you still, on some deep level, believe in the value of pain?
Sure. I mean, I wish I didn't. You know, if the church weren't enough for me, the Russian novelist certainly reinforced it. I really, really wish that I didn't. But when I look at people who seem, and they're in my imagination in this equation, they're all Protestant and blonde, who seem not to have suffered, I find them really shallow and of no interest to me. And people who have endured are of immense interest to me. The other thing that I know, though, is that, as Yeats says, too long a sacrifice makes a stone of the heart. And I very well know that too much suffering is killing and too little joy. But there's a part of me that's very romantic about pain and suffering. I don't like that. And I don't think it's right, but it's hard to dislodge.
Are you a bit of a masochist when it comes to work? Do you make things hard on yourself? Do you feel that you need to endure a certain amount of pain before you get it right when you're writing?
I do, and also I never think I've done enough. I do set goals for myself that are really pretty impossible, and then castigate myself for not having achieved them. And that seems to me kind of just boring and stupid and a waste of time. I don't really think it does me any good. One of the things that I'm working on is trying to deconstruct the model of the suffering writer in the garret, which I think is a 19th century male model and not very appropriate to contemporary women, particularly women who have strong and demanding human relationships. And I think we have to really, really look for other models, because I think this equation between suffering and creativity, or solitude and creativity, or the notion that to participate in the world is to steal from the work, is very unexamined.
My guest is writer Mary Gordon, and she has a new collection of essays that's called Good Boys and Dead Girls. And we'll take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Novelist, poet, and essayist Mary Gordon is my guest. Her latest book is a new collection of essays called Good Boys and Dead Girls. Do you still go to church at all? I know you're in some ways a lapsed Catholic, but I wonder if, especially with children now, if you find yourself going in part to give your children a sense of the church.
Well, if I go, I wouldn't go for that reason. If I didn't think that it was something alive, I would certainly not pass it on to them. One of my problems is that I have an image of what the church ought to be and an ideal of something that the church embodies that nothing else embodies in the world, which is a kind of mixture of contemplation and active love. And if that goes out of the world, I don't know another place that's going to be able to embody it. The problem is that in this world, the church doesn't embody it very well. As a matter of fact, most of the time it embodies its opposite. So I'm in a very uncomfortable relationship in which I'm unwilling to jettison the whole thing because I don't know what would replace it. Also, there's a part of me that likes being in a building or a room with a lot of people who are very, very different from me. And that's the only place in the world that that happens for me.
So you still go to church a lot?
Not a lot. Depends on how furious I am at the church in any given minute. Depends on, you know, how vocal Cardinal O'Connor has been on abortion that particular month. And how stupid they've been. I just go through periods where they seem so stupid and wicked in their intransigence that I don't want to go near them.
What relationship do you find yourself in with the church right now?
Well, as I always say, we don't do anything below the waist. That's our relationship.
I think one of the many things that has complicated your relationship with the church is the subject of abortion. And there's a couple of essays on abortion in your new collection. In one of the essays you write, of all moral issues, abortion is peculiarly conducive to displays of bad taste. What do you have in mind?
Well, I remember, well, the pro-life's displays of bad taste are unbelievable. So that in front of any Planned Parenthood, any place in New York, you see picketers walking up and down carrying pictures of what they say are aborted fetuses in black plastic garbage bags. In fact, they're not. They always show a fetus that is at a much further state of development from the point at which the enormous majority of abortions are performed. The real size of a fetus in the first trimester is about the size of your thumb, and they have, you know, things that you look like you could put into a little bunting. On the other hand, I remember when I was working, this is before abortion was made legal, when I was working to make abortion legal, I had a whole bunch of posters in the back of my car, which were pictures of a woman in a hotel, in a motel room, who had died of a botched abortion. There was this naked woman lying in a hotel room in blood. And I remember one time this kid was trying to put groceries in my trunk, and he opened these up and saw all these posters of hacked up women in motel rooms, and I realized how shocking that must have been to him. I think that the visual, that it, trying to make the invisible visible, leads people to be very overstated on both sides. And I think that that's better on the pro-choice side at this point. But the pro-lifers are the whole silent screen number is amazingly vulgar and in very bad taste. And I really have tried to work for a kind of open conversation between the pro-choice and pro-life movement. It's not easy, particularly because I think the what I should call the anti-choice people are so convinced that they have God absolutely on their side that they don't want to listen. But I think that the pro-choice people are getting much better at realizing that even women who do choose to have an abortion sometimes experience quite a lot of pain. They may not experience guilt, but they experience a real feeling of loss, a real feeling of this is too bad. I wish this didn't have to happen. Something has happened. And perhaps that something needs to be marked. And I think that's a responsibility of the pro-choice movement to mark that grief, whatever it is.
Well, let me ask you about ambivalence. You are pro-choice, but is there something about abortion that still leaves you deeply troubled?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. Because I know what it is to bear children that you want. And I know, I have seen what it is to be, to have the experience that a pregnancy is a curse. And I know how lives can be ruined by pregnancies. And I also have really worked to examine what the cortical life of a 10-week-old and 8-week-old fetus would be. And I know that the suffering, the putative suffering of a fetus is really nothing because it does not have cortical development. And that the suffering of a real woman and a real child brought to life is enormous. So I feel no ambivalence about it at all. I think it's unfortunate that people have to get pregnant when they don't want to. I don't think it's a good thing. but I have no ambivalence that abortion is often quite necessary. I certainly have no ambivalence that a lot of women would die if abortion were illegal. I think we all knew, I mean, people my age and older all knew people who died of botched abortions. We may have experienced illegal abortions ourselves and brought ourselves to the door of death because we had sex. And I know unequivocally that the world would not be better if abortion were illegal again. So I have no ambivalence about it.
You write in one of your essays that you once had a miscarriage and a well-meaning friend sent you a bereavement card, and it felt like a terribly inappropriate gesture to you.
Yes. I had a miscarriage, actually, when the baby was, whatever it was. That's, again, the problem. What is a six-month-old, whatever it is, was about 4 weeks away from viability, and I worked very hard to hold on to the pregnancy. I mean, I stayed in bed. I literally didn't move, and I lost it anyway. And one of the things that was such an isolating experience for me was I felt that something had happened to some creature that no one knew but me, and I didn't know what to call it. And when people said it was nothing, that was painful. And when people called it a death or called what I had lost a child, that made me furious too, because I knew that it wasn't. And so I think all these things are particularly anguishing for women because we don't have the language or the categories to name them and to own them and to place them in our psychic lives.
Did you think that to call what happened to you the death of a child would be to almost, well, to not acknowledge the different relationship that you have with an unborn child and the one you have with a child that's had a life, that has a history, that you really have a relationship with.
Exactly, exactly. And even the difference between, I think you could say, a stillborn child would be a dead child. But that thing that I lost still fit into a large coffee cup. And I knew that that wasn't a baby. I didn't know exactly what it was, but I knew it wasn't a baby.
Mary Gordon is my guest, if you're just joining us. She's a novelist, poet, and essayist, and a collection of her essays has just been published. It's called Good Boys and Dead Girls. Now, you write that you're often asked if you think you've substituted art for faith, and you say that would be an easy answer, but it's not the true answer, and that you don't believe in religion as art or the religion of art. What do you mean by that? And what is that connection that people sometimes make between religion and art, and why do you think it's a false one?
Well, I think they make the connection because it's about that both seem to be about the invisible or the immaterial, and that sometimes the feelings that are aroused by the experience of great art are similar to feelings that one feels in prayer or in whatever is called a religious experience. And I think there is a link between beauty and prayer or religious ardor. But it seems to me that religion encompasses much more than that. And one of the real differences is that religion has to have an ethical component to it, and art really doesn't. You can be quite a bad person and a wonderful artist. There can be beautiful things. For example, the paintings of Balthus, to me, are ethically really appalling, but they're great art. The novels of Celine are ethically horrifying to me, but they're wonderful novels. You cannot have a religious life and be unethical. So I think that is an enormous difference between religion and art.
You're teaching now at Barnard College?
Yes.
Is that still a women's college?
It certainly is.
Do you like that?
It is so wonderful that I sometimes am frightened at how much easier and more pleasant my life is in an institution which is run by women for women. It's really shocking. There's just a certain amount of crap that you have to go through on a daily level when you're dealing in institutions that are run by and for men that is so fatiguing that you don't even realize it until you're out of it. And I think Barnard is a remarkable place because of the things that don't need to be said, the things that don't need to be explained, the barriers that are not put up as a matter of course, the positions you don't have to defend to get to step one. It's very, very freeing and very, very pleasant.
Could you give an example of the type of thing you had to do at co-ed institutions that you don't have to do now?
Well, I remember I've always spent an enormous amount of time with students because I think that's part of my job description. And I remember being at a co-ed institution and a male colleague of mine saying to me, you know, your teaching is really based on a maternal model, and that's really no good. And what was unexamined in this man's sentence was that to call something maternal was automatically to devalue it. So that I was placed in the position either to say, I'm not maternal, get off my back, or what's so bad about being maternal? There are just a whole series of assumptions that always have to be countered in some way when you're in a world that's dominated by men. And after a while, you just get so tired of it.
Do you find that your students have to undo preconceptions that were passed on to them about women writers, the type of thing that you were exposed to when you were coming of age? Or do you think that women today haven't been victimized by those preconceptions in the way that your generation was?
I do think there's a change, and I'm very heartened by it. Not a lot I'm heartened by in the world, but I think that has changed, that they no longer think that the subject matter of femaleness is inferior, that there are things that they have to cover up, that they have to pretend to be men. It's just not in the air anymore, and that's an enormous change.
Mary Gordon, it was a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much for spending some time with us. My guest has been novelist, essayist, and poet Mary Gordon. Her latest book is a collection of essays. It's called Good Boys and Dead Girls. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.